Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, October 28th, 2019. It's almost Halloween, you guys. And I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. We've got a great episode coming up for you, but first I want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's because of support from listeners just like you. Some people can't afford to support the show, and we don't want to be a burden on them. So it's really cool when some of you can help shoulder that. The best way to do it is by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy. You can pledge anywhere from like 25 cents to $25 and beyond. And our top supporters always get a shout out on the show. So this week, I want to thank who? Eureka Hagman. Oh, I'm so sorry. I totally mispronounced your name. I think it's Ulrika. Ulrika Hagman, new supporter. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much. You also wrote me a really sweet letter. Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Dudas Infinitas, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. And of course, there's so many more of you who support at different levels. And I just want to thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart. All right, this week we have a really, really interesting chat. So I sit down with Dr. Sora Kim. She's an assistant professor at the University of California Merced School of Natural Sciences, but she's in this really interdisciplinary field. Her research kind of converges on paleoecology, climate change, environmental reconstruction, and stable isotope biogeochemistry. Don't worry, she's going to explain what that means. But ultimately, what we talk about is better understanding global climate change by studying fossilized shark teeth. It's so freaking cool. So I think I'm going to let her explain it because she can do it a lot better than I can. Without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Sora Kim. Well, Sora, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi.
Hi. So you are actually not that far away, but you're far enough away that it would have been a pain in the ass to physically meet. Yeah. Is my assumption, because I'm in LA on the east side in Eagle Rock, and you are where?
I'm in Merced, California at the newest UC, UC Merced.
And so, okay, newest UC in the system. How long ago was UC Merced? How long ago did they open their doors?
Oh, you know, like when they got established versus when they opened their doors are two different things.
Oh, you're probably right. Do you know when they started accepting students?
Might have been 2002.
Okay, so it's new and it's the newest, but it's still, you know, been around. Like, people have gotten whole degrees there multiple times over.
Yeah, we have reached that milestone. It is very much of a startup feel here, though, which is a very different kind of feeling to a university than most, I think.
Oh my gosh, and you guys, I'm just looking at the wiki for UC Merced. You guys are LEED certified every single building on campus?
Oh yeah, like sustainability is huge here. It's amazing.
Oh, that's so cool. Triple net zero commitment is expected to create zero net landfill waste and zero net greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. That's next year. That's amazing.
Yeah. So like my kids go to daycare on campus, or I guess only one of them is in the daycare now. The other one is in kindergarten, but her daycare building is, I think, LEED certified gold. So it's pretty cool. And I think that they're going, yeah, like you said, they're going to zero waste relatively soon. And so even at the daycare, I mean, children poop in diapers and pee in diapers. And so they're like, oh, what are we going to do about this? You know, and you can't make people do cloth diapering. So I think that they're looking into options of compostable diapers and things like that, that are tied in with the tuition rate.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Because it's like, you know, you can encourage, but you can't actually, you know, and also, like, as we know, with any sort of environmental conversations about lifestyle changes, there are risks and benefits to a lot of things and, you know, convenience and sometimes sustainability are not always in sync with one another. Sometimes they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of new technology to allow it. But sometimes, yeah, like cloth diapers, I don't know if I could do that.
Yeah, I mean, like, we're also a town of 85,000, so we don't necessarily have, like, cloth diaper service, like, yeah, an urban metropolis like LA or San Francisco. Like,
yeah.
Like, I actually did do cloth diapering for both my children, and it's a huge, like, water issue, actually.
Yeah, that's true. That's the thing we don't think about with trade-off. Like, yeah. I drive an electric car and I'm like, go me, I'm awesome. And then I'm like, oh yeah, probably would have been better to drive like an ancient Range Rover, because just what goes into the batteries themselves is not very sustainable. So there's, you know, there's hidden costs.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I just signed a contract to put solar on my house. So I am excited that like my sustainability and carbon footprint will be decreasing soon.
Ugh, I want to get there soon. I think that's like the next step. And even if, because my house is very, it has a small footprint, it's very tall and narrow, so there's not a lot of roof space. But even if I can offset the car, I think I'll feel really good about that.
Yeah, but now you can like buy into solar farms and stuff too.
That's true. You don't have to actually have them on your own roof, which is cool for people who kind of aren't in the position to be able to do that.
Yeah.
I love that. So I'm looking also at the section on like the academics that are offered at the university where you are now. You have 23 undergrad majors and 18 grad programs. And which program are you in?
So the undergrad majors that I support are a part of are the environmental system science and the biology degree.
Okay.
And so here we don't do things very traditionally, partially because we don't have a very long tradition. But if there would be a tradition and a theme to UC Merced academics, it's very much in the vein of interdisciplinariness. So our graduate programs are actually interdisciplinary. And the grad program that I'm part of is environmental systems. And it is faculty across various departments are in it. And the faculty are housed within the School of Natural Sciences, which is where I am, and the School of Engineering. So it's kind of this interesting blend of natural sciences and then the applied of engineering associated with environmental questions.
Which is amazing. And it sounds like probably the best way to do it, because of course, environmental science requires an understanding of biology, chemistry, physics, you know, like across the board, you need people from all of these different fields to like work together, and engineering, like you said. But your specific work seems like it has a really big chemistry component to it, but also a biology component. So what did you, before we get into like your research, why don't we talk a little bit about your path? Like, what did you study to get to where you are now?
I am actually trained as a geologist.
Oh, no way. I love that.
Which,
well, that makes sense.
Very many people would necessarily guess, given what I do. So yeah, I, as an undergrad, I was an environmental studies major initially, and I was hanging out at a grad student party one day, and I met a professor. He asked what my major was, and I was like, I'm an environmental studies major. And he was like, what are you going to do with that? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I like the environment. And he was like, if you like being outside and you actually want to do some like scientific skills, like you should consider being an earth sciences major, which is sort of like geology 2.0. And so I looked into the major, and it actually required a field study program where we like traveled around the most geology field study programs. You go to one field site and you study it in depth for a really long time, and you live outside in tents and you're really hot and you get to know your colleagues very well. But I went to Dartmouth College, which means that it was very well funded. And so we traveled around the U.S. and we were in the Chesapeake Bay on a boat for 1 week. We went outside of Teton National Park for a while. We stayed on a ranch in Montana for a while. We did a tour of various national parks throughout the U.S. and ended in Santa Cruz, California. And it was like totally a life-changing event for me to travel around the U.S. and sort of dissect these landscapes. And understand sort of the background associated with them. And so it was cool. And so then after that experience, I went into, I took some time off and I taught English in Korea. And then I decided to go to grad school. My grad degree is from the Earth and Planetary Sciences Department, but I actually kept sharks in captivity and essentially did a physiology experiment for my PhD dissertation, which did not...
Which must have been like a totally new thing to you.
Yeah. Like, I managed to like kill the fish that I had as a child. So the fact that I kept sharks alive was actually pretty remarkable and amazing.
That was like slide one. Like, I kept them alive, you guys. Yeah. Can we just talk about that for a little bit longer?
Yeah, exactly. Like, how amazing is that? And so, but then in my grad degree, because I was doing this experiment with sharks, and I kind of was interested in sharks for like looking at their ancient ecology and thinking about how they responded to climate change and things like that. But I was like, oh, like we actually don't know that much about modern sharks. So that's how I got kind of roped into doing that work. And so then I ended up taking a lot of ecology classes and doing a lot of biology work. And so I, at this point, I'm trained as a geologist on paper, but I do a lot of biology and have also taken a lot of biology classes.
Okay, so two things in there that were like good hints to me that we'll follow up on. We're going to talk about the sharks soon, but before that, you said that you taught English in Korea for a while. Is it safe to assume, based on your name, that you are Korean?
Yes, I am super Korean.
Super Korean. Were you born here? Were you born in Korea?
No, I was born here, but my parents, I think that what's interesting about at least like my generation of Korean Americans, at least, is that like our parents came from Korea, and by and large, like we were raised in households where Korea or being Korean is like frozen in time from the late 70s or early 80s.
Oh, funny.
And so like it's kind of interesting because like I there is a Korean American subculture within the US, but I don't necessarily fit in with that. And so I feel very Korean in that like I spoke Korean exclusively at home. We celebrated all the Korean holidays and rituals and things like that. But I don't actually have very many like Korean friends and things like that.
You know, it's funny. My kids' sisters, I have two twin sisters that are Korean that my father's wife adopted when they were infants.
Oh, cool.
And so they had like a very different experience in that they were born in South Korea, but they grew up in a not at all Korean home. And so I think my father's wife, and this was before they were married. So I met them when I was like nine years old or something is when we started our relationship, and they were like seven. But he or she, I think, tried, you know, she would make Korean dishes at home and she would take them to like language school and they would try to do things that were traditional, but it was all very through like a weird white lens. And so, you know, it's always really interesting to me when you look at like kind of intersectionality and what and culture and biculturalism and multiculturalism, how everybody's kind of ethnic identity is really, really different. There's so many within group differences, even if you're talking about what a lot of people might think of as like a broad culture, like, oh yeah, they're Korean. It's like, yeah, but what does that mean?
Yeah, there's such nuances to it. And I do a lot of work towards diversity, equity, and inclusion, or sort of thinking about social justice and equity within higher education, and especially focused on STEM fields. And that is something that's always interesting in terms of like the lens that people talk about these types of issues, is that underrepresented minorities kind of get homogenized and the nuances get lost in the conversation of what should we be doing, or how, what are effective practices and things like that. I think that we oftentimes say like underrepresented minorities, and that's just like a big group. But in fact,
yeah, like it means anything to be a gay Black woman is the same thing as being like a, you know, a Sri Lankan man or something. It's like, yeah, it's like, okay, there's a lot of variation within there.
Yeah. And even I mean, I have not really met very many other Asian American women, I don't know, whatever I call myself, biogeochemists, like stable isotopicologist. Mm-hmm. But I can guarantee like the other person that I would meet would not be me.
Yeah, that's so true. Oh, it's so interesting. Like, so my, for people who listen to the show, they might already know this by now, even though I don't really talk about my my work that much on the show when I'm interviewing people. But I've finally gone back to school after a 10-year hiatus to like do my PhD. I started one 10 years ago and dropped out. And so I switched from... Oh, thanks. I'm a third year. Woo, I'm getting there. So my master's was neuroscience, but now I've moved into clinical psychology. So like patient interaction is a big part of it. And my orientation is existential, which has a much more focus on the individual than on like sort of like trying to homogenize groups. Mm-hmm. And then my concentration is social justice and diversity. So it's like a big part of my training. And it's so interesting reading basically the literature, because it's one thing when you're reading about people's kind of philosophies, which is a big part of psychology. That's what I love about it. It's like equal parts science and equal parts philosophy. Mm-hmm. But it is also really interesting when you read the actual research literature, and you see like that sort of the ethnocentric monoculturalism. That's what the term that we use a lot, like ethnocentric monoculturalism in America is like white Christian men.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Like
they're
the predominant power. We normalize them when we talk about like something being the case. It's the case. It's like the white Christian men case and everything else is the other.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is that the other is bigger than the norm or the, you know, the normatization. And like we just said, there's more like within group differences than between group differences. But we, like, people are literally only recently realizing that a big part of like cultural sensitivity and cultural competency, especially let's say you're seeing clients, is to know enough about a culture to not be completely alien to it, but also to not assume that you know about the person you're talking to because you read about their culture.
Yeah, once.
Exactly. Or even if you're steeped in it, right? You have no idea if that person is like rebellious against X and Y, but very traditionalist in this way, or, you know, like
that's true. Just,
we're all so different.
Yeah. And I mean, my husband is also Korean American, but our families are so different, you know, like the interactions between our parents, our relationships with our parents. We both come from like fairly stable, you know, loving, very loving, not even fairly, like very loving family. But it's like, yeah, there are differences. And when I was living in Korea, that was something that I like. On the outside, you know, Koreans actually dress very similarly, I found. Like, I'm not someone that really follows fashions and trends very much. It's like quite alarming for me to go to Korea and be like, oh, everybody wears a Burberry scarf in this winter.
Yeah.
Everybody has to have a Burberry scarf. So I had a hard time, like, actually visually picking people out of crowds. But then like in meeting people, I had had such limited interactions with Koreans before I lived in Korea. But then when I was living in Korea and embedded it within the culture, it's like, oh no, there's like a whole spectrum to this like culture and socioeconomic groups and all of that. Like you would, like there should be, and like, you know that there is, but I don't know, like those nuances are hard to pick up on until you're there.
Oh, it's so true. I'm lately been really interested in research. It's not my field at all, but it's one of my professor's fields. This comparison or this relationship between creativity and whatever the hell that means. So like, obviously you have to measure it by other constructs, like things like openness or... you know, the ability to change your mind very quickly or things like that. But this relationship between creativity and travel, creativity and bi or multiculturalism, creativity and being bilingual, like exposure to lots of cultures and how it actually affects your ability to be cognitively flexible. Because I think one of the things that's a real kind of bummer about American society specifically is that, and I don't blame people for having never left the town that they grow up in, because I know financially it's very burdensome to travel, especially if you live in the States and you don't live in a big hub. And, you know, we're like a big island, basically, that's like really far away from everything else. So we don't have the benefit like a lot of people in Europe do of being able to get in the car and drive to another country.
Yeah.
And so I get it, but also I feel bad and I worry about people who have literally never left and never been exposed to other cultures and never been able to just experience all the cool stuff that the world has to offer. Because honestly, I feel like it's a real privilege that I've been able to travel as much as I have.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I love traveling. And I think that that was like one of the best things related to being in graduate school and also the research that I do, that I do travel quite a bit. And I think that like sort of what you're touching on related to traveling and sort of seeing other places and the importance of that, that's actually like the foundation of like why we need diversity in higher education and in STEM, like how people approach questions and problems and come up with solutions or experiments. It's shaped by sort of their background and their cultural standing and all of those factors. And that that academia, especially in STEM fields, is so based on the predominant like white male Christian perspective, means that we're really limiting what our capabilities are, I think.
I know. I think it's sometimes hard for people who are like in privileged positions or in like normative positions to understand like, okay, because they'll say, well, what is like being trans, for example, or being bisexual or being Korean American or being a woman have to do with, you know, climate change? Like I just, or like have to do with maybe, you know, the molecular expression of some specific thing. And it's like, that's such a narrow point of view because it's not just about the research question, but even it even does have to do with the research question. Yeah. But even beyond that, it has to do with how you approach problem solving, what kinds of tools you use, how you think about whether or not something is feasible in terms of financial burden or in terms of, you know, the number of steps, parsimony, like all of those things are culturally prescribed. And it's hard for people who are normative in the culture to think outside of that main view.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is true. And I mean, geology is like, and geosciences are one, is one of the fields that is the least diverse of all of the sciences.
Really? I had no idea. Yeah. I always thought it was like, just kind of like math, computer science, and physics are the really bad ones. And then like chemistry is getting better, biology is getting much better. And then psychology is actually kind of completely flipped. And it's much more women and it's very diverse because of course the nature of psychology is that it's like welcoming, but it still, you know, has a long way to go. Don't get me wrong. And also we have that leaky pipeline problem where no matter what field you're in at the tippy top, it's still all white dudes.
Yeah. And in some ways it's just a matter of time that things have to cycle through. But yeah, in geosciences, things are not good. Like there was a study published last year in Nature Geosciences that found that diversity in geosciences had not changed in 40 years. Like in terms of like the male-female ratio, they've changed. But in terms of ethnic diversity, no change. And in some sub-disciplines of geosciences, not a single Black person gets a PhD.
I had John Urschel on my podcast recently, a couple of months ago, and he is an ex-NFL player who's getting his PhD at MIT in mathematics.
Oh, cool.
And he's a super cool, very fun story, really smart guy. And he was telling me, you know, as a Black man in mathematics, like he doesn't have Black professors.
Yeah.
He's like, I've never met another Black person in my field. Like, that just, it isn't a thing that happens, mm-hmm. you know? And so, and it's one of those things, of course, and we probably don't have to, like, beat a dead horse. Oh, God, I hate that expression. But, you know, it's very hard for people to see themselves in a position and determine whether or not that job is even a viable option for them if they've never, ever seen somebody who looks like them doing that job.
Yeah, and I think that... to a lesser degree, I can really relate with that. And that really resonates with me because for a long time, I had never actually been directly mentored by a woman, much less a woman with kids. And so when it came to the time where I was like, I'm pretty sure I want to have kids. I was like, oh gosh, like, am I going to be able to stay in academia? Mm-hmm. And
like, is there anybody I can talk to about this?
Yeah. And like that you stay married also, like through the process of having said offspring. And yeah, and it was like a major, major freak out for me. And I remember that I had recently sort of come to this realization that I did not have women and especially women with kid mentors. And so I had gone about like trying to find people to be my mentors in this capacity. And so when I found out I was pregnant, I called this woman and I was like so worried. And she's like, no, it's gonna be fine. It's great. Like, and it has been fine. It's stressful. It's hard, but I think that that's the case for most engaged parents with young children. And that there are challenges, but and I think that also in my case, in reflecting about these types of things with in terms of through the lens of diversity, you know, like for different cultures, there's a different importance level and prioritization of family, whether it be to your parents or to having children or being married and being with like relatives and things like that. And
it's so true, especially like here in the States, right? The normative culture is like individualist. Mm-hmm. It's very isolated mm-hmm. from other generations. You don't have multi-family households unless you are, you know, a first or second generation from another culture, or somehow it maintained after multiple generations. But it's even though we're a nation of immigrants, it's rare that sensibility has, you know, stayed throughout the generations.
Yeah. And so I think that that is also can be like a big inhibitor for people mm-hmm. to stay in academia in terms of like diversifying academia and seeing themselves with this as like a viable path forward.
Well, is it common, like, I mean, we were talking about kind of how progressive and forward thinking your campus is. Is it common that there are daycares available on university campuses for the faculty?
Yeah, I would say it depends. It depends on the campus, but quite a few universities do have now daycares available on campus. And if not, they have relationships with daycares nearby that might have like small discounts and things like that.
Gotcha. And of course, I guess there's the benefit of like having, if you have a psychology department, mm-hmm. that those researchers are like, yeah, we'll watch your kids.
Absolutely. Or like an early childhood development education mm-hmm. department or something like that is also, it sort of all ties in together as well. But it is interesting sort of navigating this. And when I was a grad student, it was not on my radar at all as something to think about and worry about. But now as like an assistant professor with young children, it's something that I think about all the time.
Yeah. And I mean, and being a young professor too, I think that, you know, we talked a little bit about role modeling. I swear we're going to talk about your research soon, but I'm looking at a press release about some of the work that you do. And there's this wonderful little snapshot of you in the lab with like a very young female student and an almost equally young, it looks like kind of Latin American male student. Mm-hmm. And like how, like you were just saying that you didn't have that when you were in school. I think, you know, a lot of people our age or older didn't have that, especially depending on the field that they were in. But how cool that you then get to offer that to your students. I mean, and these are undergrad students, but I could see that, you know, if somebody was struggling with like having, you know, deciding on family planning or figuring out if they want to stay in grad school or what, they could come to you and they could talk to you about these things.
Yeah. I mean, that is, I would say it is not an insignificant part of why I've chosen to stay in academia and specifically come to UC Merced. I had originally accepted a tenure track faculty position at the University of Kentucky. And there, the population is not as diverse. And when this opportunity came up, one of the things that really spoke to me was the diversity of the campus. And so we are something like 60% Latinx, a student, undergraduate student population. I want to say that we're close to maybe 10 or 15% Asian, and we're not particularly like the majority Asians that are represented at universities are like Korean, Japanese, Chinese, but we're actually more South and Southeast Asian populations. And so, yeah, we serve a really diverse student body. I want to say something like 60% of our students are also Pell Grant recipients, so receive really high financial aid. And then close to 60% are also first-generation college students.
Wow.
So that adds up to more than 100%. intersectionality.
Yeah, some of those things cross over. But how cool that, like, you know, but that also means that as professors, you guys are tasked with being, you know, being mentors. You're not going to be able to get away with not being there for these students who don't necessarily have the culture at home of understanding the college experience and being able to support it in a way that, you know, somebody whose parents are doctors would have.
Yeah. And I think that that is something like, while I myself, I'm not Latina, but that I come from immigrant parents who didn't necessarily understand the American educational system and to universities and even graduate school. And no one in my family had a PhD until me, that that I can relate on that level with my students very well, I think. And when students are saying that, like, yeah, like, I really want to stay in California because my family is here and I want to be close to my family, I'm like, yeah, that's totally valid. And that's okay for you to feel that way. You know, like, whereas I think that in more traditional academic type of mindset, it would be like, oh, well, you know, that's just part of academia. You know, you got to move a lot.
Yeah. Better get used to it. You got to move. Yeah. My major professor, she's, in her 70s now, and she's been a psychologist for, you know, a very long time. And she was, when she was in grad school, she had young children. And she told me that she literally had professors look her straight in the eye and say, well, what's more important to you, your PhD or your kids? Okay. And she would be like, both?
Yeah.
Like, I don't do that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine, but that's, you know, that's the culture.
Yeah. And I mean, when I was in grad school, I got engaged, and I remember that one of my classmates also had gotten engaged, but she got a ring. And so it was like much more obvious to people. And I remember being in the mailroom, and a fairly young male professor who had also just recently gotten engaged been like, oh, there's like, there she goes. Like, she's not going to continue in academia, you know? And what? I was like, I also got engaged. I just don't have a ring, you know?
Yeah.
And sort of like, called him out on it. And and then he like was like, oh, well, and I don't know, like, it should, we should be able to be like whole people as academics.
Well, and we are. Other people should see us that way. And that's the other crazy thing. It's like, you just got engaged too.
Yeah.
Like, what is wrong with you? Because, I mean, what does that imply, really? Like, talk about sexism. Like, that implies, too, that, like, your male partners, I'm going to assume, maybe I shouldn't even assume, but that your male partners require so much caretaking that you can't possibly stay in academia.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. And like, I mean, I would say that I was able to stay in academia because of my partner, that he like, I mean, he moved with me. Like I did my graduate degree at UC Santa Cruz, and then I went to Wyoming and University of Chicago for postdocs. And then I took a job at Kentucky, and then I moved back to California. So he has been with me on that entire circuit.
Yeah.
And all the while, like, having two kids. And so, like, I tell my graduate students, all of them, that who you choose as your partner is actually the most important decision, professional decision that you will make. Because of, like, some old-fashioned sensibilities, but rather like the degree of support that you have and their willingness to move, or, you know, in the case of women, sort of support them by not necessarily conforming to gender roles in the household, for example, and being willing to help out with laundry and dishes and all those other things that are often given over as like the mental load of women.
Yeah, and childcare.
Yeah, exactly. And that, like, having an actual partner who works with you to get through these things is super, super important to your professional success. But yeah, I think that those are types of conversations that don't usually happen necessarily in mentor or like advisor kind of relationships. But I think that it's actually very important to have those conversations and to be open to them if we want to start doing something about diversity in academia, and promoting students from diverse backgrounds, not necessarily to become professors even, but to stay within STEM or to finish their degrees and stuff.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, like, I think sometimes when we talk about women in academia, the conversation does go to, you know, child rearing or to some of these other, you know, what we think of as traditionally things that are traditionally in the realm of women. And the truth is that those are very important conversations, but there's so much more, like we were saying, you know, being near your aging parents, for example, or maybe having to do additional work in order to be able to support or fund your academic endeavors, or, you know, whatever the case may be. A lot of people, I think, historically have been like, well, handle your shit. Like, that's not the role of a mentor. Whereas it's like, no, that's absolutely what a mentor is instrumental in helping somebody do, because you cannot be successful in academia if you don't have good mental health, and you don't have appropriate life-work balance. And those things are not just things that you can turn a switch on. Those are daily decisions. And for some people, you know, like myself, who struggle with mental health issues, those are things that are, you know, they're ongoing. And to have understanding professors can be life-changing.
No, and I think that it's, I spoke with our new incoming graduate students in my program. And that was one of the things that I actually said to them was like, yeah, this is grad school. It's really intense. And while you were most likely like excelled as undergraduates, like there's going to be a lot of stress and maybe some anxiety that comes with graduate school. And it's important to take care of yourself, both physically and mentally. And the great thing about being with the UC program is that that the graduate students are represented by a union and have amazing healthcare. And for me, when I came to grad school, it was the first time that I had health insurance, you know, and dental insurance and vision insurance. And it was awesome and totally life-changing. And it's like, yeah, you guys should totally take advantage of it, because we, as your faculty advisors, we're paying for your health benefits and they're not cheap. So like, fully take advantage of them and get the help that you need, both like I mean, physically and mentally. And let's not discount the importance of mental health here.
I have to say that, like, it's so wonderful to be able to talk to somebody about these issues, these concerns, who isn't necessarily in a field that you would think would raise these issues. Like, it's just by virtue of being you and of having the considerations and the interests that you have that these things are, you know, equally important to you. But your work is like, is on like climate change and shark teeth, which like, you know, you're not a social scientist. You're not working in psychology. You're doing this really, really interesting work that feels like it's very far-fetched, but of course all this stuff applies to you. So I want to talk about that work. You're, one of these press releases calls you a paleoecologist, which I think is a very cool title. Is that the title that you generally would use if you were describing like what you do or who you are as a scientist?
It really depends on the audience. So I'm like some strange combination of like ecologist, physiologist, and chemist. But I think about things through like geologic time. And so I'm just the nature of my work is highly interdisciplinary, and it kind of depends on who the audience is as to how I describe myself. I oftentimes tell my students or my friends that when I get on an airplane and I don't actually want to talk to the person that's sitting next to me, when they start to try to, you know, have small talk with me, I'll say, oh, I'm a stable isotope by a geochemist. And like,
I love that.
That like, shuts people down so hard. They're like, okay, never mind. Nothing good to say to you. But then like, you know, if I'm feeling like, oh, I'm just going to like, you know, have a glass of wine on this flight and just, I don't know, peruse Facebook or whatever and like not worry about working. And somebody asks me what I do. And I'm like, oh, I study modern and ancient sharks. And then people are like, oh, well, the last time, my favorite like Shark Week story, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And people will talk to me forever about sharks. So, yeah, I think that because I'm so interdisciplinary and most people, I don't even know how to describe myself. So I don't expect that other people would necessarily understand how I would describe myself, that I just kind of tailor it to who I'm talking to.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think sometimes within the sciences, the stages of research have different implications for the audience, right? So, you know, we're going to talk about like how you do what you do. But before we talk about how you do what you do, maybe it's important to talk about why you do what you do and what the outcomes of that are. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's where probably the ecologist side of things come in, isn't it?
Yeah. So what drives my work is really trying to see how organisms will respond to essentially climate change, environmental change. And so a lot of my work does focus on sharks, but I also have projects with pronghorn, with wolves, with lake sediments, with plants. Let me see. I have this whiteboard where I write all of my projects down. I have a project with rats. Yeah, so I have a lot of different projects, a lot of different types of organisms. But the reality is that we are facing some dire consequences to climate change. And I think that in California, it is very, very apparent, perhaps especially right now as we're like going through rolling blackouts from prescribed by PG&E from wildfires.
Yeah.
And so like climate change is a real thing. And in reality, like, the Earth is still going to be here. Like, it's been here for a real long time. It's just a matter of like the devastation of climate change is how humans and life as we know it continue. And so if we want to actually be able to manage and conserve and especially protect biodiversity, we need to have a sense of like, what are the tolerances that we're capable of dealing with in terms of climate perturbations. And the geologic record is actually a great place to ask those questions, because in rocks, in fossils, we have evidence from past climate change experiments, most of which have like not necessarily gone so great. And so from this record, we have to sort of deconvolve a variety of things, being like, what was the temperature? What was the CO2 concentration? How did animals that survive, like what did they do? How were they able to survive? The animals that didn't survive, like why didn't they? What was their ecological tolerances? And so that's kind of where my research sits.
Very cool. And so is the reason that you're able to do research, predominantly on sharks and looking at shark teeth, but also on, like you said, pronghorn and you know, sediment and rats and all these different organisms or ecological systems, is the reason that you can do such wide kind of reaching stuff because the core kind of methodology or, you know, what you're actually doing by looking at these isotopes is similar throughout each different maybe organism?
Yeah. So the method that I use is really the common thread through all of my research, and it's stable isotope analysis. And so, stable isotopes are the same element, but a different number of neutrons. And so the slight difference in weight makes the atom interact differently through different chemical, biological, and physical processes. And so in fossils, we mainly have oxygen and carbon stored in the hydroxyapatite for their enamel, or in sharks, in their enameloid. And so that's what I'm analyzing. And I took this deep dive into physiology with my PhD dissertation that I sort of referenced before, because there are nuances to the physiology of different animals that regulate how these isotopes are partitioned for different groups of organisms. For example, oxygen isotopes are really regulated, the sorting of the heavy versus light isotopes is really heavily determined by the temperature of the environment where the hydroxyapatite is forming. And so for a mammal who are homeotherms, like the changes in oxygen isotope values are actually changes probably in the environmental water that they're drinking. Whereas
because they are changing they're maintaining a core body temperature that's pretty consistent.
Yeah. Whereas then for sharks, because they're living in an aquatic ecosystem and they're ectotherms, it's a combination of both the temperature of the water that they're living in and then also the oxygen isotope value of the water that they're living in. And so it's kind of, there's more confounding factors, but it's important for us to also understand that system, as well as terrestrial mammals, or marine mammals are hard to study with this method, but are doable. But the reason why I'm able to study so many different systems is because of my methodology. And while I got into what I do because I love the outdoors, in reality, I just spend a lot of time in essentially a chemistry lab.
It's funny. I hear this when I talk to paleontologists a lot too. They're like, you know, you do all that when you're a grad student, but you're just in the lab after that. Yeah. I'm interested though, like, and maybe this is kind of a naive or silly question, but how is utilizing stable isotopes to kind of understand the ancient environment? What's the difference between what you do and like radiocarbon dating, for example, just finding out the age of things, because doesn't that also utilize isotopes?
Yeah. So carbon 14 is what's used in carbon dating, and that's a product of radioactive decay. So it's very important to have time constraints on the environmental and ecological changes that are happening. And so various methods of dating these events and situations are also important, which is, so carbon 14 dating, that is a very important field as well. And I'm interested in not only like the timing of when it happened, but then what was the intensity of the change? So for example, in terms of climate change, like how much did the temperature of the water change? Or how much did the size of sharks change in this environment versus that environment? And then what was the water temperature in those two environments, or what was the salinity of the water that the sharks were living in? And so tying those sorts of ecological components with also the timing of it is important.
Oh, interesting. So it's the radioactivity of the isotopes that allows you to figure out when something was in existence, but you're actually looking at stable isotopes, like not radioactive isotopes. And that gives you information about, like it gives you a fingerprint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it gives you sort of fingerprints of potential ecological or environmental change. And so I will say though that with C14 dating, you can only really, I think that it's only good for about, it's been a long time.
Yeah, it doesn't go back that far, right? You have to use different isotopes for super old things.
Yeah, so for a lot of the work that I do, because I'm looking at things that are on the order of like 35 to maybe 56, 55 million years old, I don't use radioactive isotopes, or I don't use C14 dating. I do have some projects that are related to lake sediments, and for that, we do use C14 dating because those are very modern. I think of them as very modern, but they're still like 10,000 years old.
humans were around then. Like it's still within our lifespan, which, you know, on an ecological scale, or I'm sorry, on a geological scale is super modern. So you're looking at things that are like, you know, I think we sometimes forget that sharks have been around like through the dinosaurs, not through, but like during part of the dinosaurs. Oh, yeah. Like sharks are old, like really old.
Yeah, they've been around for 400 million years. Yep, through the dinosaurs. They have been around for a very, very long time. They have actually been quite successful in their role as carnivorous marine organisms, cold-blooded organisms. And it's kind of fascinating because they've actually only gone through two bottlenecks in terms of their diversity. And so they've been successful through periods of mass extinction and climate change. And so that was kind of what made me interested in digging deeper into studying them. When I had started my PhD, folks had not really done very much shark paleoecology. And I would say that it's still not super widespread, but even with modern shark ecology, it had not really been explored with stable isotope analysis. And so that's why I did, I kept sharks in captivity and fed them different things and looked at their soft tissues and physiology. But, so it's kind of been interesting and cool to sort of see this technique mature and develop sort of in sync with my professional development.
Yeah. I mean, okay. I know this is kind of a side note, but like, what were the outcomes of those two bottlenecks? Because usually when there is an evolutionary bottleneck, like you'll have a new kind of sort of, I don't know, branch or a change, right? That occurs. Like, how do you know that there are two bottlenecks and how did they affect the shark?
I don't know that we necessarily have a great answer for that, honestly.
Cool.
Yeah.
I love that about science. It's like dissertation.
Yeah.
There's always something to learn.
Yeah. There are different, I think that they were on orders of sharks, but there were maybe a couple orders that went out, but it's not super clear if like certain size classes or certain, they weren't necessarily living in a certain type of environment that went extinct either. And so I think that that is very much like to be determined.
Oh, cool. So it's not like with whales where we can class them and say, like, those are baleen whales and these are non-baleen whales. And these are two different kind of evolutionary, like, arms, and they have different features and traits. Like, generally, sharks are sharks.
Yeah, they do have differences. Like, there are ground sharks versus lamniform sharks. Lamniforms are mostly, like, fast swimming, go long distances. Mm-hmm. But then there's also crossovers within different groups as well. It's not as cut and dry as the whales, for sure.
Gotcha.
But the whales get complicated, too, when you go back in
time. Yeah, they do. Yeah, they get really complicated. I recently had Nick Pyonson, maybe it's not that recent anymore. Yeah, on the show, and we talked a lot about the, you know, paleo, I don't even know what you'd call that, paleomammalogy of whales. And it was fascinating. I was like, gosh, I never knew.
I know.
There were so many questions to be asked about whales.
Yeah. Nick and I actually, we went, we spent, I think it was a week or 10 days in Peru together when I was in grad school, looking for fossil whales and sharks.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's amazing.
World.
Worlds colliding. Yeah. And of course, you know, you work a lot with teeth because these are, I mean, they're kind of, I don't want to say easy, but they're easier to find than bones, right? Because sharks just like constantly make teeth and lose them.
Yeah. And sharks don't have bones. So
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. They're all cartilage. You're right.
So they only have cartilage, mineralized cartilage, but and their teeth are made, the apatite that makes up their enamel, which is actually called enameloid in shark's teeth, because it's formed slightly differently and has some different properties to it. But it's a fluoroapatite, so it has a lot of fluorine in it. And that actually makes it more resistant to degradation in the fossil record. And so a single shark probably goes through, I don't know, many thousands of teeth in its lifetime. And so that in combination with also that their enameloid is so much more resistant to degradation, make it that our fossil record has a lot of shark teeth.
Yeah. I mean, I even have one. I have a big megalodon tooth on my bookshelf here. And it's so cool because it's like, you know, it's old. It's so old, but you hold it in your hand and you feel like it could have been from today.
Yep.
I mean, it's a fossil. It's the wrong color,
wow.
But it's really cool to like hold a piece of an ancient creature in your hand like that. And then, of course, you do much more than hold it in your hand. You're able to actually investigate at this like atomic level, basically.
Mm-hmm.
What's been going on with this animal. And you're looking at environmental change to try and understand climate change. But I'm interested, like, isn't what we're dealing with right now, this anthropogenic climate change, sort of a different class? We know that we've been through some really serious swings in the climate. We know there have been multiple ice ages, and we know that it's been very, very hot. It's been very cold. The glaciers have been almost completely melted. There have been times when it was like almost all glaciers. But didn't all those changes happen a lot more slowly than they're happening now?
Absolutely. The rate of change today is what is so alarming about today's climate change. Today is a very, very different ballgame in terms of the rate of climate change and how animals will respond. But still, if we want to have any sense of what it was like in a time that it was very hot and with high CO2 concentrations, looking at this period of time called the Eocene, which is from 35 to about 56 million years ago, is a good time to look. And so some of the work that I have going on right now is to look at responses to the shark community off of the coast of Antarctica during this time period.
Okay.
And so during this time period, the Drake Passage was opening, and that's the area between the southern tip of South America and the Antarctic Peninsula. And so with the Drake Passage opening, and then also the Tasman Strait opening that's near Australia on the opposite side of Antarctica, with those opening, they allowed for the Antarctic Circumpolar Current to form. But before these openings, there was no Antarctic circumpolar current. There was no glaciation at all on Antarctica or the Arctic. And it was really warm. Wow. The Arctic and the Antarctic had this one group of sand tiger sharks at both the very north and the very south. And the temperatures and other fossils that are in the area suggest that it was pretty warm. We're finding temperatures on the order of maybe like 16 to close to 20 degrees Celsius. So very different realm than today. And so during this time period, we're sort of studying how the changes in the shark community, like the differences of the different species, but then also the temperature, their body size, and maybe we're exploring different ways to get at their diet as well, to see how those change through time.
Fascinating. And so is this the research project that is tied to a recent kind of really large NSF grant that you and researchers from really all over the world are working together on?
Yes. I actually have two NSF grants that recently got funded. So thank you to NSF.
Oh, very cool. And are they for two different projects or do they combine for a single project?
No, they're for two very different projects. Their common thread are stable isotopes and sharks. And so, yeah, the one project is exactly what you're talking about, or what I was talking about, and what you're referencing is an international team. And so I am working a lot on sort of the sharks and stable isotope analysis. The other paleo shark specialist is Dr. Jürgen Krivet from, he's at the University of Vienna in Austria. And then we also have a component of neodymium isotopes to track sort of how different oceanographic currents were happening with this time, since we're looking to track the extent of opening of the Drake Passage. And that is with Dr. Howie Scher. He's at the University of South Carolina. And then we are sort of wrapping it all together with analysis in climate modeling. And for climate modeling, we're looking at the difference orientation of sort of like the tectonics with the gateway and the positioning of the continents, different CO2 concentrations through time. And then what's really novel about the climate models that we'll be running is also that they'll have isotope tracers in them for both oxygen and neodymium. And so that is with Dr. Alex John at CU Boulder and Dr. Matt Huber at Purdue University. And
what do isotope tracers do?
They are sort of, isotopes are what we're actually measuring in these teeth in terms of the data that we're collecting. And so by putting them into the model, we're hoping that the outputs from the model, we can compare them to what we actually get from the shark teeth and use it as a way to sort of say like, oh, well, this model is probably more accurate than that model. That this model, these components of it look like it might be better for like near shore sharks, but it looks like it's not so good for the sharks that live really deep in the water column and things like that.
Very cool.
Yeah, and
so this really is
the person that's keeping us sort of honest and has actually been to Antarctica and collected fossils and thought very deeply about the geologic history and geologic record there is Dr. Thomas Morse, who's at the Natural History Museum in Sweden.
Gotcha. And so this really is not just a multidisciplinary team, but also like a multinational team. So you've got perspectives from all over coming together. I mean, publishing is going to be fun.
Yeah.
Have fun with that writing process.
Well, I will say that the thing that I'm excited about is that I'm very excited and like all of my collaborators. And so that's
good. Yeah.
That's a very intentional part of how I have built various projects since I have gotten my PhD and such, is that, yeah, like a mentor once told me at the University of Wyoming, he was like, oh yeah, life is too short to work with people that you don't like. Yeah. And he's right. And it's so true. And so I think that that's sort of been my mantra that I've stuck to since then, is to make sure that I work with people that I like and that I enjoy their company and who I want to see when or talk to when I'm thinking about my science.
Genius. Yes, absolutely. That's so important.
I will mention my other NSF project, only because you mentioned your megalodon. My other NSF project is actually to look at why megalodon went extinct, or to try to figure out why megalodon went extinct, and to see if it was changes in oceanographic patterns and processes, or if it could have been related to diet.
As you're learning more about megalodon and collecting your data mm-hmm. and developing these theories, can we please talk about maybe making a new documentary for Discovery Channel where we help people understand that megalodon actually is extinct and we have a conversation about why, instead of people thinking that megalodon is still out there swimming in the ocean somewhere?
Yeah, that would probably please? Be good. Well, we should with the Discovery Channel featuring more women as sharks.
Yes, please. Yes, we will do both of those things at the same time. Two birds. Yeah. Gosh, isn't it frustrating? I mean, obviously, I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours, and I'm going off on a thousand tangents, but like, isn't it so frustrating? Like what we talked about for the first whole half of this representation mm-hmm. in both the sciences. And of course, I'm somebody who works in media as well as a science communicator. So like, this applies almost to the same extent, if not worse, in media. Mm-hmm. Like Hollywood has its own huge problems with representation. Isn't it, in addition to that, so frustrating sometimes to feel like we're swimming upstream in a landscape that for some reason feels the need not to celebrate actual scientific discoveries, but to maintain narratives that are based on intuition or that are based on shock value or, you know, whatever the case may be, instead of weaving actual science, what we know to be a good approximation of truth, into our media narratives. It's so frustrating when you watch a program that's supposed to be on a science-based network and you're like, well, none of that is true. And we know that. Yep. Why are they still saying this?
Yep. Absolutely. I think that, I'm really an outsider when it comes to shark ecology and shark paleontology. I wasn't trained. There are specific sort of faculty and universities that really specialize in shark ecology, and I come from none of those places. There are also places that really excel in paleontology, and the University of Chicago is one of them, but I did do my postdoc there, but they don't do a very traditional flavor of paleontology, I would say. And so I'm not like really trained in either of these things. And so I really come into shark paleoecology from an outsider's perspective. And I read these papers that make these assertions about the ecology of ancient sharks, or why they were able to persevere, or like why they have so many teeth, or this or that. And I'm like, but we should be able to test this. Why are we not using data for this? They're like, we should be able to also see this in like modern sharks. And why are we not collecting data so that we can translate between modern and ancient ecology? And so that is kind of a lot of what I would say motivates my work is, I'll just hear somebody say something or read something of like, oh, anecdotally, people say that, like, for example, the shark teeth in this area are a lot smaller than this area. And it's like, well, we can get a pair of calipers and measure this, actually, folks.
Yeah. That's like not even that hard to do. Like you could do that on the cheap.
Yeah. And so it's kind of been interesting that as this outsider and thinking about these types of questions and I just call it like arm wavy science. And like when you dig back into the literature of like, for example, things saying that like sharks with pointy teeth are like grabbing at fish, whereas sharks with serrated teeth are biting and tearing flesh. But if you actually look at modern sharks, it's not so cleanly delineated between those types of foraging behaviors. And so there's all, I mean, shark teeth have to be shaped the way that they are for a reason. Like they're not deciding to expend all of this calcium, which is like a pretty limiting nutrient in many cases, to just come up with all these teeth and all the different shapes and sizes and stuff, you know? So it's like, let's start, you know, like poking at these things and digging deeper into them. And so my research program kind of goes off in a lot of tangents, not just in terms of organisms and time periods, but also questions into things like that as well.
I love that. Well, it must keep you really in it. You know what I mean? Like, because you're not, you do have a singular kind of theme and like a broad singular focus, but you're able to really explore and, you know, take multiple tacks. That must keep you really interested all the time in your research because there's kind of always something new.
Yeah. I mean, it might actually be a fault. But I have learned that I can't switch between too many projects in one day or else my like the wires in my head start getting crossed and I start having like shorts in my brain. And then some days I'm like, gosh, I am really tired. And it's because like, oh yeah, I like did a lot of mental work on four different projects today. And, but it is really interesting to me. And I think that I, because I have sort of this interdisciplinary research program, I can, part of that is being able to speak the language of these different subdisciplines and such. So I find it super exciting and fun to talk to oceanographers and ecologists and physiologists and geologists and chemists and just this whole host of various people. And so usually when I meet people and I ask them what their research is, I'm like, oh, I have this like random question related to sharks. Like, could we do this? And then it just adds like another project to my board.
I love it. I love it. So, okay, we talked about like these two big grants that came in, I think both this year, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are two big projects that obviously you now absolutely have to focus on because you're being government funded to do so.
Exactly.
Are they, I know that you're working on a lot of things, but are these kind of like where your head is at right now? Is there anything new on the horizon that we didn't talk about? Or is that kind of going to be your focus for the next probably, you know, couple of years at least?
Well, no, I actually have two other projects that are, well, actually three other projects that are probably taking up a lot of my bandwidth as well. One is a project looking at historical wolves and how climate change and human interaction has affected the variation in their diet within individuals and among individuals through time, through historical time. And that's work that my postdoc, Dr. Robin Traylor, has been working on with me. And then I also have a project where when I was a graduate student, I had the awesome opportunity to go to Japan for an entire summer and work with a professor, Dr. Sho Tanaka, who he actually was the first one to describe megamouth shark, which was, I think that it was discovered like in the late 70s. It's kind of crazy that like a fairly large shark we didn't know about until the late 70s.
Yeah.
But I went to work with him and I didn't know very much about sharks at that time. But he helped me collect a bunch of various shark tissues from deep sea sharks off the coast of Japan. And part of it was I didn't have the resources in terms of money to analyze the samples. But then the other part of it was that I don't think that I necessarily had such a clear interpretive framework for the data set either. So these samples have been untouched since they were collected in 2005 or something. But I have three undergraduate students in my lab who are working on these samples. And so one student was working on liver and muscle tissue samples. And then I had two students working on teeth. And their teeth are actually kind of cool because shark teeth are continuously growing and there's different rows of teeth. And so we are analyzing teeth from different rows to get a sense of how their diet is changing through time, which is also kind of what muscle and liver tissue also do. And then my last project that I'm really excited about is actually much more related to hormone and energy balance. And so a close colleague and friend of mine at the University of Kentucky, she studies sort of how hormones regulate energy and water and such. So she raises rats in a laboratory setting. And so we actually took out the gonads of male and female rats and then kept the gonads in some of them. And then we fed them all the same thing. And we're trying to track to see how, these hormones actually regulate the nutritional physiology of the rats. And so in wild ecological studies, we oftentimes look at differences of stable isotopes and we say that it's because they're eating different things or foraging differently or something like that. Mm-hmm. But we're actually finding that there are differences among individuals just based on their hormone levels. So it's like, oh, like maybe we should think more about, you know, the physiology of the animals and sort of like what life stage that they're in as well.
Ah, I love that. And that almost takes us back full circle to the stuff we were talking about at the beginning about humans, you know, this idea that we so often will homogenize an entire group based on certain characteristics and just assume that, you know, those characteristics sort of account for the majority of the variance. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, there are a lot of individual differences, even in animals that were bred to be utilized in the lab. Yep. And yeah, how important is it to understand that? So yeah, oh, that's so fascinating. Sora, so many cool projects going on right now. And it's true, kind of if you were to pick them off the wall, you might think, how are any of these related? But then you start to see this kind of central thread as we figured out through the show. So I don't want to keep you for much longer, even though I think it would be really fun to get back together with you sometime in the future and catch back up. But before we do go, I have to ask you the closing two questions that I ask everybody when I have them on my show, because I feel like you're going to have potentially a different perspective. And of course, you work on these big ecological issues. So who knows, those might feed in. But are you ready? These are kind of big picture questions.
Sure.
Okay. So I want you to think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you. It could be your work. It could be, you know, something personal. It could be kind of bigger picture global issues. And the first question is, what is the thing that really does keep you up the most at night that you're most concerned about, you know, maybe even pessimistic, borderline cynical? What are you really, really worried about? And then on the flip side of that, so, you know, we bring things up a bit. What are you most optimistic about? What are you excited about? What are you genuinely kind of looking forward to?
I think that I have the same answer for both.
Oh, cool. I love that. I love the flip side answers.
Yeah. And for me, it's whether I'm doing right by my students, I think is what both keeps me up and gets me really jazzed and excited. That I worry and think a lot about mentoring and how I'm supporting and advocating. But then also sometimes like you have to have those hard conversations and really draw boundaries and make sure that people realize when they're not understanding or when they're not behaving or not being respectful. You know, like I don't try to police people's behavior or anything, but and like what is that professional and personal line?
Yeah.
So that like keeps me up because I do want to do well. And I am very straightforward with my colleagues, but also my students. And in some ways, with students, I could probably get away with not having some of those uncomfortable conversations, but I force myself to because I think that it will only like serve to help them in the future to sort of have
it really
that
will.
Awareness. And in reality, I want them all to succeed. And so to help jumpstart that process is important. But then like, I'm also really excited for my students and where they're going and what they're doing. Like a lot of the students who work in my lab, like the graduate students, I have first generation, I have students who moved here from the other side of the U.S., but also the other side of the world. Like one of my graduate students, he came to work with me from Italy.
That's awesome.
So I'm excited for their work. For my undergraduates, I hope and I try, you know, to give them meaningful research experiences that they get excited to continue in STEM and that they have opportunities and that they consider and want to go to graduate school. And that I've been sort of like a positive influence in terms of professional development for them. And so like I can sort of see them developing and maturing and producing data and getting excited, which is also super cool. So, yeah, I think that that's probably what I spend the vast majority of my time and energy like rolling around in my head associated with my students and their like potential and what they're doing is the research as well that I'm excited for the directions of my research. I think that when I started my dissertation, I had these grand ideas of looking at shark paleoecology, and thinking about deep time questions. And then I got kind of sucked into this vortex of modern ecology. But it's really cool right now to be able to say like, oh yeah, I'm like working on these like really interesting and cool problems. Like you say Megalodon and like people usually have some kind of response to it. And so it's cool to have a project, a funded project where the National Science Foundation like deemed that our ideas were like worthy and good enough to put some money at. And then similarly, like my project with the Antarctic sharks, I mean, my collaborators are people whose papers that I have read for a long time and that I
That's so cool.
Now working with them is awesome, you know, and super validating. So it's all very exciting and cool.
Very exciting, very cool, and totally badass, I have to add.
Thank you.
Sora, this has been so much fun. I've learned an awful lot. I'm interested for everybody listening, you know, where can they learn more about your work? Is there, like, do you keep a website or are you active on social media or anything if they're interested in following the cool stuff that you're up to?
Yeah, I do have a website. It is sora.leekim.org. And then I also am on Twitter. My handle is Sora L. Kim. And I am also on Facebook, but that's more personal stuff. So probably not as relevant. But a lot of my posts, especially on Twitter, have to do with diversity, equity, inclusion, and sort of social justice.
Very cool.
So that is very much like a core of what I do and what I think about. And I think while oftentimes it is treated especially in STEM, as sort of like broader impacts and like outreach activities, I actually think that to start being part of the change, we have to incorporate it, that it's a thread within our research program and our teaching and our mentoring, and not seen as like this other category of things to do when we have time or energy.
Oh my gosh. I'm like here. I don't know. I can't clap my hand. I can't do enough clap emojis or 100 emojis for that. So with you on that. That's so great. I just started following you. I'm excited to see all the things you talk about. Yeah. Well, gosh, Sora, thank you so much. I had such a blast chatting with you today.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.